Yes, it's very well regarded. And there's some really great habitats there. There's some unspoiled areas. And I think a lot of the attention goes to the Isle of Man, you know, because of the TT and other tourist attractions. But there's some great habitat down there for seabirds. Still has that good wintering hen harrier population as well. And, you know, a lot of the areas are compared to the mainland, largely unspoiled. It hasn't been, you know, tainted with huge swathes of industrial agriculture. So, yeah, it's good for wildlife. And, of course, in the sea surrounding it, we see now an increasing number of cetaceans. And famously, of course, the basking sharks, which appear in the summer, which are a great draw for people like myself.
Absolutely. I mean, I appreciate you'll be on the island for a flying visit, really, just for the night. But will you get a chance to get out and about? And do you have any sort of favoured spots?
The last time I visited, we went on a quick tour around to some places that I haven't been. I mean, obviously the view from down on the Calf is fantastic. The coastal landscapes are brilliant as well. But I love the theatre. The theatre is a great place to be. I've been over a couple of times before and spoken. Always busy, lots of good people, lots of good stories, good atmosphere. And from my point of view, it's an opportunity to actually speak to people face to face rather than from, you know, through a television, which is a bit one-sided, obviously.
I want to come on to a bit of work that was done by a local bird charity on the Isle of Man. They're kind of the Manx branch of the RSPB, really. And they did a seabird census, and they showed that the island's biomass had declined by more than a half. I mean, does that kind of revelation sort of mirror what's happening elsewhere in Britain?
It does, and it also says very clearly to the people of the Isle of Man that whilst you have a relatively utopian existence because of your isolation and the unspoiled nature of your coastline and countryside, you are nevertheless not immune to that that's impacting us from a global perspective. So the reason why those seabirds are declining are principally twofold. Firstly, overfishing, which goes back years and is not a problem which is restricted to the Isle of Man nor its waters. And the secondly, the impact of climate change is having, because our waters are getting warmer. And this means that our fish are moving and they're breeding in different places. And a lot of those seabirds in the summertime are dependent on young fish, not the adults, but the young fish to feed their own young on. They're the right package size, if you like, in order to be able to catch, carry and feed to their young. And if they've shifted, then it's just not optimal for them to be nesting where they previously did. It's too far for them to fly to find those birds. And what we found with satellite tracking studies of birds on the Isle of Man, particularly things like shearwaters, is that they're travelling vast distances to find their food. You know, they're going way up north of Northern Ireland. They're going right down the Irish Sea, you know, into that part of the Atlantic in order to find their food. So the sort of, you know, the energetic economics of their situation is becoming implausible. And it's sad, of course, that those declines that are being measured there mirror those which we see not just all over mainland Britain, but throughout Europe and in many other places in the world too.
I mean, across your career in conservation, I mean, you've talked about urgency now and a couple of factors that are at play, you know, a couple of legacy issues, perhaps with overfishing as well. Where does the current state of the environment rank in your eyes?
Well, it's been in constant decline since I've been aware of its plight, and that's probably one of the reasons that I'm so energised and fuelled to try and make a difference. I'm 58 years old. You know, since I became interested in birds, 90 million have disappeared from the UK mainland. You know, 50% of the world's wildlife has disappeared in that same period of time. This is on my watch and those who share my age and interest. And therefore, you know, the urgency is really hitting home. I've got a limited amount of time to make as big a difference as I can in order to retrieve this situation. So trying to communicate that desperate urgency to decision makers is something which is increasingly important, not a job to be left to just people like myself, but also to other people who are prepared to speak out about it, and more broadly to the public, whose, you know, increasing concern and sophisticated understanding of the plight of not just these species but our own is coming to the fore. And I do feel that in the next few years we're going to see, you know, increasing amounts of hopefully peaceful activism to try and turn our decision makers around and make sure that they look further than the short term. And that certainly needs to be done. And as I say, you know, Isle of Man will not be immune from that. We're all connected. We're on one small planet. We're one species with one problem at one time. And we've got to sort it out together.
Well, you've mentioned the A word, the activism. I mean, most of our Manx Radio listeners will know you as the presenter of Spring Watch, someone who's clearly knowledgeable and passionate about, you know, British wildlife. But can I ask you about when you appeared in front of a pink boat that was bolted on the road at Oxford Circus earlier this year? What is it that appeals to you about Extinction Rebellion?
Well, they're peaceful protests. They're non-violent demonstrations. And we know historically that these sorts of protests have invariably been successful. The suffragettes movement utilized this means of demonstration. The human rights movement in America used it. Gandhi used it on the Salt March. We know that we don't have to be destructive. We don't have to be rude or violent to achieve our objectives. Frankly, we can just sit down in the road. And yes, okay, sitting down the road is illegal, but it's non-violent. And the Extinction Rebellion protests throughout the course of the summer have changed many people's views on just how critical an issue climate change is. We've seen the instigation of climate and environment emergencies in all sorts of institutions, not just our governments, but within independent bodies such as universities. Even this week, the Musicians Union have declared a climate and an environment emergency. And whilst that might seem a little glib, remember that they have an enormous capacity to communicate with people who I can't, because I'm not a musician. I'm a sometimes broadcaster who talks about natural history. So the more people that we get thinking about this more quickly, the better the chance that we have of rectifying the problem. And the problem does need to be rectified, because as you've already mentioned, we've seen the impact of that on the Manx seabird population. It's hitting home to everyone through our extreme weather events, through changes in our wildlife, that we have to change our practices in the way that we live. And we're doing it. We've got to open our minds. Tomorrow morning at 12:30, I've got an appointment in a local garage that sells electric cars, because I think it's now time for me to make the switch. I think the technology's there, is available to me. And I'm going to talk about that tomorrow. So there's a change. 5 years ago, I wouldn't have been thinking about an electric car. I would have thought, yeah, do you know what? They're not worth the money. The batteries don't carry them far enough. Where am I going to charge it? Blah, 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 blah. And now I'm thinking, do you know what? I don't really have any choice. If I'm going to act responsibly at this point in time, and if the technology is available, and I'll find that out tomorrow, then I have to make that switch. And we've all got to change what we do in order to make a difference as quickly as possible.
And I mean, for those concerned then about protecting wildlife, you've mentioned there about going for an electric car, but it's not necessarily always feasible for families to make that switch. It's still quite costly. What can people do elsewhere? I mean, and indeed for those who just want to make a difference on that personal level with regard to climate change and the environment.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Electric cars are expensive. I'm going to have to part exchange another car to be able to afford it. But I think as more and more of those vehicles become available, the price will go down, and then more and more people will be able to make that switch, which will be good. But in the interim period, there are a plethora of things that we can all do. And the single most important thing to do is to empower ourselves to realise that we can do those things. It's to get up and think in the morning, do you know what, I might just be one person, but I can make one difference today. And I always say the most important tool that people have in their arsenal to achieve this is an alarm clock. Just set it 15 minutes earlier and use those 15 minutes to communicate via social media, to think about how you can save and conserve power in your house, to how you can cut down on your plastic consumption, how you might minimize your resource use, because ultimately that's what it comes down to. It's about consumption. We're all consuming too much too quickly, and it's putting too much of a burden on our planet. And there are a plethora of ways that we can all involve ourselves. And if we all do, that's not just one small difference. That collectively becomes one significant difference. So self-empowerment is the most important thing we can all achieve.
Obviously, not everyone is lucky or fortunate enough to have perhaps a platform like yourself as a broadcaster, as a conservationist who wears many hats. I think it's fair to say that you can sort of don your activist hat now as well. Do you feel then that there's sort of... we did touch on it before, that perhaps there's more of a responsibility on people like yourself, perhaps in communicating the state of the natural world to an audience.
Yeah, no, I agree wholly. I mean, what's my voice worth if I don't exercise it for good? I have a small voice because I broadcast on natural history. There are plenty of people out there with a much louder and broader voice than my own. It's time for them to stand up and be counted. They're living in the same world. They're under the same pressures. They will, it's time for all of these people to stand up. And we've seen it. Anthony Gormley has spoken out this week about the sponsorship by a petrochemical company in the National Portrait Gallery. Mark Rylands has resigned from the Royal Shakespeare Company because of a similar sponsorship thing. So people, across all walks of life who do have a voice are beginning to exercise that voice. And that this is what we need to see more of. There are plenty of people out there at the moment who are cowering in the shadows of a problem which is going to bite them very hard in the bottom. It's time for them to get out, get on their soapbox and start telling everyone the truth about what's going on.
So you do believe then that there is this kind of growing feeling amongst your peers, you know, who are experts in their own right, be it in science, climatology, ecology, conservation, you name it, that they're sort of finding themselves perhaps needing to politicise what they do in order to be heard?
Yes, well, politicise in one sense, but it's very much with a small p. I mean, when you look at Extinction Rebellion don't have a defined big P political agenda. They're not affiliated to any political party, and their campaigning is focused on, you know, poor decision-making or indecision-making by a plethora of parties and peoples across the world. You know, they are very clearly an environmental movement. We're interested in positive environmental change. And in order to do that, we have to influence our decision makers. So that's where the politics comes in. But we all have that power to influence them, because we have a vote every now and again, and we can put an X in a box. I don't think that we can wait every 5 years to make our opinions, you know, heard. We have to do that with greater urgency. So rather than waiting just to put a cross in a box, I think we have to speak more frankly to our decision makers about our concerns, in this case, when it comes to the environment. And that's why we have to entertain thoughts of activism when they're not listening. And frankly, as we know, they're preoccupied, many of them, with short-term objectives, which don't suit environmental recovery. And as a consequence of that, we need to wake them up. And we can do that by peacefully, passively and democratically demonstrating. And that's what Extinction Rebellion approved. And they will continue to garner my support so long as they stay peaceful and passive and polite. We are, I hate to say it, and I don't do so with any degree of arrogance, we are morally, ethically and legally right to take that stance. And that's what we need to do at this point.
Just moving on, your legal group, Wild Justice, it's currently promoting a campaign that's raising awareness of what they call the suspicious disappearance of hen harriers on British grouse moors. I mean, I suppose it's a bit of a naive question, but what do you suspect has happened to these raptors? Why have they gone missing?
Well, we know, we don't suspect, but we know that the principal reason that they're disappearing is through illegal persecution, and again, principally on driven grouse moors. I can say this without any ambiguity, because that's where we find most of the crime taking place. And it is a crime. This is illegal persecution. It's as illegal as speeding, robbing post offices or doing over a bank. There's no doubt about that. We're campaigning against this illegal activity and indirectly against driven grouse shooting, very specifically, because that industry is underpinned by this illegal activity. It's very disappointing that unfortunately, these criminals are besmirching the reputation of the wider shooting fraternity. We have no beef with them at all. We just want the law upheld. And the law in the UK at the moment states that you can't kill these birds of prey. And that's it and all about it. And the very sad thing is that whilst the Isle of Man is not, you know, covered in grouse moors, its hen harriers suffer because, unfortunately, at certain times of the year, they move from the island onto the mainland, where their habitat preferences mean that they do move to grouse moors. So we have seen birds that have been ringed on the Isle of Man, tagged on the Isle of Man, are reaching the mainland and disappearing under suspicious circumstances on driven grouse moors. And we all know what suspicious circumstances means. It's very hard to gather evidence in these areas, but nevertheless, we have gathered enough of that evidence in the past to show that there's a strong correlation between illegal persecution and driven grouse shooting. And so this is something which we must sort out. These are valuable parts of our ecosystem. They're top of the food chain predators. They're also iconic species, which many people like to see. And as I mentioned, you know, the second time I came to the Isle of Man, it was to film a hen harrier roost in the wintertime. And I watched at that point about 20 birds going in. It was a thrilling evening. Unfortunately, those roosts are not as busy now due to this persecution.
So very much in the interest of Manx residents who adore these birds, the policing of these grouse moors.
Yeah, very much. I mean, as I say, you know, it's all about that connectivity, isn't it, really? The birds on the Isle of Man, just like the birds in my back garden, don't belong to me. You know, I listen to warblers every morning that will fly all the way to Africa. We share these species and we share the responsibility of looking after them. And so if the people on the Isle of Man, you know, cherish their hen harriers, as indeed we know they do, they have to equally be worried about them when they visit the UK mainland, where in some places they are very sadly still imperiled. So there is no reason why, you know, that the Manx people shouldn't be joining with us to try and see an end to this illegal persecution.
Just coming onto your show, Chris, it's entitled Pictures from the Edge of the World. For those who are going on Wednesday, what can they expect?
Well, I mean, I take photographs, you know, wherever I go. Subsequent to my previous visit, I've been down to Antarctica, which is pretty much the edge of the world as far as I can get anyway. I've been taking a whole series of pictures down there, so I'll include some of those. The message, you know, is there. I'll talk a little bit about photography, but nothing technical. I don't get into the technical details, more the stories of how the photographs were taken. And then there's obviously underpinning it all, a bit of conservation. And I'll be showing some pictures from the UK as well, of course, to ensure that we're all connected with what I'm talking about. And the back, I get as much a thrill out of looking at things in my back garden as I do at the edge of the world. There's no doubt about that. And again, you know, from my point of view, as I mentioned at the outset, it's an opportunity for me to engage with the audience on a personal basis. So it's a give and take thing. I have plenty of questions at the end, and people can make them as difficult as they like. If they want to know when the Battle of the Alamo is, I'll endeavour to tell them.